Hello and welcome. You're listening to Adventures in the Vale, an RPG discussion podcast. I'm Jake.
I'm Ross.
Sit back and relax by the fire, for there are tales to be told.
Cozy Crow, come and sit by our fire. May I get you something to drink?
Yeah. I'll take an ale.
I'll have that right out.
Welcome to the Adventures in the Vale Tavern cast. Here we talk about folk tabletop role-playing games. My name's Ross McClure. I'm joined again by my friend Jake.
Hi, I'm Jake. I am Ross's friend, and I have no other qualities.
Today we have with us an artist, a designer, tabletop RPG guru, author of a bunch of stuff, a bunch of games, Index Card RPG, 5e Hardcore Mode, owner of Runehammer Games, and known by some as Runehammer, by some as Hankren Fernell, others Brandon Gillum. Welcome to the podcast, Hankren.
Yo, thank you very much. Good to be here. I also have no other properties besides those aforementioned.
Nice.
Which is sadly just a quite few more credentials than what I have. But yeah.
Those were just products. Those weren't me.
that's true. That's true.
Let's see. Actually, all right. Hankren, we wanted to have you on just to chat about stuff. I think part of it is Jake and I were big fans of your content. We've gotten a lot of benefit out of your advice over the years. We have a lot of your products have been very useful for me and in my games. It's brought me a lot of joy. So part of it is we want to just reflect that back to you and say, hey, here's the cool joy that this has brought. And then throw a couple questions at you.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. That means a lot. I mean, that's the whole reason to do it, really. Well, you have to get groceries, too. But other than groceries, that is freaking awesome, man.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so the first question I've got is our play club. It's called Mythic Mountains RPG. And we were kind of formed around this idea of, like, what is right? What is true? Where does authority come from? And for us, we said that's going to come from the table, where whoever's sitting at the table, not the internet, not a book, and not companies, it's stuff like that. So as somebody with a bunch of books and a company and on the internet, what do you think about this idea of folk tabletop role-playing games? That's the first thing I wanted to ask about.
Absolutely.
Your thoughts on it.
Love it, because I live by that. I live by that code. And you know what? It is a difficult code. Like, in my sort of community, in my sphere, we refer to that other side you're describing as the armchair. That's what we call it. So the armchair is, it's definitely part of the hobby. You know, it's where you're thinking about it. It's where you're reading. Maybe you're researching something that you're actually not going to play. Or you're pondering in your journal. Or, I don't know, you're just pontificating about like a hack that you might implement, or maybe a cool character class you want to invent or something. But that armchair, even though it's definitely part of the hobby, it's part of what we all do, it has to live a little bit in the backseat of the car. And it's beautiful and we all love it, but I couldn't agree more that, like, the, as you call it, the truth with a capital T, it does live in the collaborative space. And I think the way that you can see that, if you're looking for proof, or if you're looking for, you know, a sort of a burning bush to prove your thesis, that burning bush is how different everything is when you're sitting down there with your friends in person, and how different everything plays out than either what you thought it might or what you were told it might be like. It always just goes wildly different. And just the fact that that's true, and everyone who plays on a regular basis knows this is true. There's no reason to even argue it. I think that fact right there just makes you go, as Arsenio Hall would say. It like, you can't help but notice, like, man, we talked about, like, I don't know, your barbarian powers being OP for like 3 weeks before we played. We got to the table and you were the worst character in the group. Like, when that happens, you've got to acknowledge that there's a difference, a significant difference between the truth of the table and the theory of the armchair. And I couldn't agree more. So you guys' term is, you call it, that's folk. That's your word for it. Folk is the stuff that actually happens.
Yeah. And then it's things like, you know, the difference between Dungeons and Dragons as could be expressed as a product, like you can go and buy it at Walmart or you can subscribe to it. I know that's like a thing right now, but I mean, even before that, like before like we're talking about kind of everybody had a subscription, you know, to D&D Beyond, but other things too, like this idea that it could be exchanged. Uh-huh. and that kind of stuff, that it was like a property versus
it's a brand.
Yeah,
like, or a brand that you wear and you
have little wear stuff. And I do that. I mean, actually, it's dirty, or else I would have worn my Dungeons and Dragons hoodie. But, you know, alternately, you know, tabletop role playing games as something like fishing. You know, like no one owns fishing, and no one can exactly tell you. They could give you some tips on fishing, but also fishing is different for different people. Mm-hmm. And the only way that fishing can ever really be fishing is to put something in the water and try to get a fish out.
Yep.
And only when someone does it.
Catching. It's called fishing. That's the first thing you learn with fishing. but yeah, I agree. We call it, another word we use for it is hermetic. Like,
ooh, hermetic.
Hermetic. The actual substance of our hobby is hermetic, in that it is somewhat sealed away from anyone's real access except those who were there. It's the ultimate form of you had to be there.
Yeah, and that's what everybody says, right? They're always like, you just gotta see it, right? You gotta experience it.
Yeah, it was mind blowing, and then you try to tell someone about it, and it's like telling someone about the dream you had where you were a chihuahua and you were on the Super Friends. You know, like nobody wants to hear it. But as I think it's an interesting question you ask me, because as a purveyor of purchasable things, you know, how do I ride the line between knowing that this is the truth with a capital T, and yet make my living, my only living, on selling things? And I think the answer is sort of it's a voice aspect. So I know that I can never get anyone the thing. I accept that. I'm really comfortable with that. But for me, I think the fundamental drive behind what I do has never been to be like, this is the thing. It was always much more that just there's this voice that has been plaguing me, to be honest, since I was like 6 to 8 years old. And it's never ending. Like I seemingly can't get relief from it. It is a never ending itch to sort of shake the claw of death metal at the world, not in a negative way, but in a positive way. Anybody who's into metal knows they're like the nicest people on the planet. And so like, the death metal claw toward the world is not me cursing the world. It's me, like, saying my thing. And I have not been able to stop this since I was a little kid. And in many cases, to my detriment, I might add. You know, even my business, I have a vastly underestimated business. So, you know, I have a lot of readers and a lot of fans, and it's really exciting. But I don't know if you guys notice, but I really am quite private about the actual scale of my business. I don't do Kickstarter, and people don't truly know the scale of my business. And I keep it that way because that was never my goal. My goal has always just been like relief, like to get it out. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it doesn't even really matter if what I create even is the sort of the thing as you describe it, because I'm just trying to get it out and just make the voice stop. You know, it's like, I don't know if you've seen that crazy movie, The House That Jack Built, right? So a super uncomfortable horror movie. It's really, really bad. So just a content warning to anyone who's thinking about watching this movie. But the story is basically this crazy sort of serial killer who he only does what he does because he's just trying to, like, sort of get it out. He just wants it to sort of end. He, like, wants to scratch his itch. And the itch goes so much further than he could have ever imagined because he's kind of being, like, absorbed by hell and stuff. It's really great. But in a weird way, I creatively relate to that. Like, it's not like I even necessarily want to be this, that, or the other thing. It's just happening. And I'm just, like, yeah, trying to
hopefully,
get satisfied.
Hopefully with less murdering, hopefully.
And less bodies, less body count, hopefully. But yeah,
what were you going to say, Jake?
So that difference between folk and what I sell is almost just sort of another rock in a river that I'm floating down. I watch it go by.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I agree a lot of times with my own personal experience. I think there's a lot of drive and a lot of motive to create. And it just kind of pours out. And I wish there were a lot of times where I didn't do that because I don't have the years of experience and skills to articulate my words and make rules that are easily understood, and like these spells that are broken because they don't have the right rules, and then they just bust my game and make it really weird and awkward for everybody at the table. But I just, like, have the need and the desire to, like, bring forth my ideas and, like, this creativity that kind of pours out. I don't have a great funnel to pour it into, and it just spills and makes a mess, and I have, like, notes and scribbles like a madman on my walls, and yeah. But I agree, it's not something that you can control, you know, and inspiration is a fountain of never-ending, sometimes negative motion, sometimes positive emotions.
Yeah, well, it's like the old saying, you know, what's the difference between doing art and doing craft? And the difference is that people doing craft are happy. Mm. Like, art is a never-ending struggle of, why isn't this cooler? Oh, wait, I should be doing the other thing. I have these three other things that are maybe going to happen. I should have done XYZ. I didn't proof it enough. Oh, wait, here's a shiny thing over here. You know, like, the life of art can be at times sort of torment. But when it's good, it's the best.
Right, I agree. And I think to bring it back to what we were saying earlier about the armchair and this idea of it being different than the table, to me, like, I actually get a lot of joy out of the armchair thoughts, and a lot of my creative endeavors go in that direction. The play at the table has a lot less to do with me and a lot more to do with my friends and elevating my friends. And there is that dichotomy in my hobby of, like, armchairs for me, and then the table is for them, and I get the joy out of that because it's from them. But yeah.
Mm.
So it sounds like this is a creative and force, and one of the results of that I'm hearing you describe, it sounds almost to me like the difference between a fixed-based thinking and a growth-based thinking, where you can kind of break the cement up, and as I heard you say, you want that death metal, like, shaking the orthodoxy of things. I often talk about, like, the orthodoxy of play. Mm. Now, when we talk about stuff, I love to talk about it from the reference or point of view of, like, a culture. You know, like, so if you're doing story game stuff, let's do Dungeon World, right? And they have people, like, approach things a certain way. Or if you're playing old school essentials, let's do that. And, you know, let's do the rulings over rules. And I have fun. It's almost like going to different countries and kind of tasting the food, you know. but what I don't like is this is how it has to be across the board, like what I would call it, orthodoxy. And I run into that sometimes. And one of the things I wanted to share with you that I got out of something you posted recently, maybe you can kind of help me represent this to the audience in an accurate way, is this idea of pedagogy in tabletop role-playing games.
Yeah.
That there's, like, you know, all right, hey, we're doing Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. Because one of the common things is, okay, we do Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition, let's try Dungeon World because it will give us tools, or let's try Mouse Ritter because it's going to break something. You know, we're going to learn neat things, and we're going to bring that back to our favorite game. Mm-hmm. But you're saying, hey, correct me if I'm wrong, let's start at level one in old school essentials with one hit point, and it's going to change the way, like, we're going to experience that. So my experience is going to be the same as my wizard's, my magic user's experience. And I get to, like, journey with that magic user.
Yeah.
And the actual journey itself is better for it. Not just a matter of mastery, but I tried this out. I wanted to tell you. I tried it out in two ways because I've been doing a lot of old school stuff and having a blast, having a great time. And I'm like, you know what? I need to go back to these story games and see and start back. I guess I started as a game master at level one, really. So I'm like, let's do Mutineer Zero and let's try, like, and see how this goes. And it's so uncomfortable.
Yeah, you like, don't. You're
like
not all awesome.
I don't
at
know
it.
How to do. No, not at all. Right. Like, and I'm reading Mutineer Zero, and I'm like so uncomfortable. I'm like, that's not how that works, you know. And at the same time, I did one other one, which was way more uncomfortable, which was Traveler. So I'm like,
oh man, you brave soul.
When I was a kid, I loved science fiction, but Traveler is based on pulp sci-fi, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. And that stuff wasn't allowed in the middle school library, you know, like the things that were in those books. So I never read it. So here I am. I want to be a Traveler referee. And I start trying to run Classic Traveler and read Space Viking and read Poul Anderson and read, you know, and watch. Who's that space adventurer? I can't think of his name, but, you know.
Duck Dodgers?
the guy, you know, the one that Star Wars is so much heavily based on or borrows from, Buck Rogers. I am completely like level one, level zero at this, like,
yeah.
And Traveler, you're going to start at max level with all your stuff and you're old and there's no like, you know what I mean? So like, and the result was, I think, I had a blast, and I didn't just get tabletop role-playing games out of it, although I did. Now, I will say the consequence of that is I had to make mistakes, and the other thing I feel like is I ended up having more fun in the jank of the mistakes than I think I would have if everything were nice and tidy.
Absolutely.
Because I picked up the Classic Traveler book, and I'm like, I'm just going to do it without... I'm just going to read what it says and see what it has to say and try it out. Mm-hmm. You know, so anyways, that was my experience with this pedagogy of play. I don't know if you could help, you know, so in case anybody hasn't watched that video, help kind of crystallize that for people listening. But,
well, yeah, I mean, it's, as you mentioned, it's the idea that you are learning as a actual living human on a similar curve. Usually it's a little bit ahead of the curve that your character may be learning on, and you may have multiple characters like a GM, but that just difference is kind of meaningless because, as you mentioned, the key to it, pedagogy just being a super neato weird word for like learning techniques or teaching techniques, and I think what's fun is that you don't get that weird feeling of, I mean, we've all seen this, right? There's like a player who has played everything under the sun to its ultimate conclusion and then comes to your group or your table or whatever, and you guys are going to start as like villagers, right? Or some, and already as a player, he is or she is in the future, sort of mentally. They are already knowing this sort of large swath of material and of ideas and of potentialities. And so the difference between them and their villager is vast. And that isn't bad by any means. We all have to deal with character knowledge versus player knowledge. You know, that's a part of the fun. But I think when that gulf gets too big, it's almost like it's like going to the gym and like lifting paper clips. Right? Like nothing's going to happen. Like, you're going to be, A, a little bit bored, and B, to your point, especially, Ross, like, you're not going to get no gains, bro. Like, you can't sort of lift under your class and really get, I think, what the sort of the thrill is. So, you know, like, I just read this great article that in the sort of the 2020s so far, like, since about 2015, this sort of syndrome has been growing in, like, just general human culture, called the crisis of comfort. And it's basically a lot of people, I suppose, according to this research, are extremely not okay with going outside of things that they know and do well. And on the one hand, we can all relate to that. It's like, oh, hell yeah, you know, you do you, baby. You know, do the things you're good at. But there's all these frontiers of fun and growth and sort of wackiness. A lot of times it's just wacky because you're doing things wrong. That I think await the brave soul who leaves comfort. And this is true in many, many avenues of life, but definitely in RPGs. That experience of being the coolest GM that everybody knows. You know, like, oh man, you got to run our game. I heard your other game is so sick. And I'll be like, yeah, that would be dope. Let me, you know, let's figure it out. But you're that guy. And then they pull Mutant Year Zero on your ass or something. You know, they pull out Traveler. And you're just like, and you got 3 days. You got 3 days to figure this shit out. Like, and then you waste two of those 3 days painting miniatures. So now you have 1 day, sir. So you're coming to the table. And you're like, I think the equipment is on page 35, but don't quote me on that.
It's embarrassing. You know, you mentioned lifting paper clips at the gym. That's basically what I lifted today. And I mean, you know, I'm the chubby guy at the gym. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to go in there and like in Traveler and a lot of and I like veteran players. It's astonishing how predominantly kind people are. Like.
Absolutely. You know, well said.
It hurts when 1 out of 10 aren't, like, because that's what you're afraid of. But like, it's astonishing when you're the chubby guy at the gym. People really root for you, and they want to see you succeed. You know.
It's just like the old saying, Zen mind, beginner's mind. You know, the beginner has all the doors open, and is the one that's embarking and has all these different forking paths ahead of them. The expert is the one who has only one path left. You know, the path gets narrower and narrower and narrower the further you go, because you've opened all these different doors. You've got, and it becomes harder and harder to access that childlike mind, which is the Zen mind. It's the happy mind. It's the learning mind. So the beginner is always who everybody's. This is why everybody loves kids, man. They're annoying.
Yeah, it's true.
Hell.
Everybody loves kids.
They're so annoying, and their emotions are so volatile. But everybody roots for them.
Jake doesn't know about that.
Everybody roots for them because they're at the beginning, and it's like, man, you could do absolutely anything. Like, I only got one leg over here, bro. I'm all beat up and old. Don't think about me. You're the one that's cool. Like, you know, open up the doors and go for it. So, yeah, I think being the beginner on purpose is definitely something that is undervalued, both in our hobby and in the world at large, because of that embarrassment. And it is real. Let's not candy coat it. You do get freaking straight up embarrassed, just like, bam. I mean, especially people around you, like, kind of know their shit a little bit, and you're the new dude.
Yeah.
And you're just like, okay, everybody, roll 2d6 for your defense roll. And they're just like, what game are you playing, bro? Like, oh, that was last week. okay, yeah, this is d20. Is that what we're doing?
And it could be the wild thing is having both of those things at the same time. I talked to Matt Finch about this, and I have this obsession, like, how can we pave the way? How can we make it so easy? I'm talking to somebody right now. They were in a original the Swords and Wizardry game I run. We keep 2 slots open so people can hop in and try that. And they tried it out, and they're like, I love this. Now, the point that they're at is that they don't know to use a D20 to attack. But they know that they want – that's not a disparagement. We're talking about – this is the good part, right? The good part is that they're enthusiastic and they have a passion. They love it. So my obsession all the time is like, how can we just, like come in and do this? Like, this is so much fun. I want more people to come in and share in this. And usually that is, and I think this can often be true, usually that is, how can I fit all the rules on one page? So that's one approach.
Yep.
But I was talking to Matt Finch about this, and I asked him about like that AD&D, original D&D strand, where people are interested in the source literature. They're interested in, you know, not so much the rules, but how do we make Conan the Barbarian come alive? How do we make Clark Ashton Smith like come out of the game? Mm. And how do we feel that? And Matt Finch was like, that's going to be hard. He was answer. Like, it's going to be hard. You're going to have to work. But also, he was kind and supportive, and you know, so it's like both things. So some things are worth the pain, I guess.
With us,
fun too, the journey.
That's an interesting little rivulet, because with us, you know, we, at least one of my groups, our sort of stated mission is to feel the vintage feel of D&D. But although we do feel the vintage feel, because I, you know, I can't lie, like my pedigree is 100% legit on that front. Like I can bring that. I walked the path. So I have nothing to hold back as far as bringing the vintage feel. But the players are such a component of the fun that we are enjoying together. I cannot say with any honesty that we're like anything like Conan or Ashton Smith in any freaking way. Those modalities of storytelling are very old, and I think at this point very obscure. More obscure, I think, than sometimes people who are in our hobby might realize. But like, I do think that like original Conan is something that very, very few people know about, and Clark Ashton Smith being even more obtuse. You know, you want to talk about some weird Hyperborea shit, like, you know, like, with him, it's like proto-Lovecraft weirdness. You know, people do not know about that stuff. So we don't create any of that, but we do get the vintage D&D vibe really nailed. You know, like the occasional shocking death, you know, sort of really simple Vancian magic, you know, like extremely simple equipment, you know, extremely slow XP, you know, and like some monsters that have some kind of foibles that are just like, what? You know. But I think that just modern players are such that it's very hard for them to get into that. I think you'd need a somewhat advanced fantasy enthusiast to get anywhere near, you know, a Cimmerian vibe. That is extremely, like, curated.
Well, like I said,
that's a really narrow little hole to shoot through.
That's true. I'm certainly, I'm speaking to... That is your goal. Like, so if you want to pick up Astonishing Swordsman and Swordsman of Hyperborea,
yeah.
Well, you probably want that. That's probably what you're there to do. And so you know, but, I forgot what I was going to say.
Okay. I'll jump in here. Yeah. What I was going to say is, it sounds like you guys agree that there are rules that exist out there. If you're going for a certain vibe and you want a certain feel, there are pieces that you pick up and you plug them into your game, and then all of a sudden you have your experience that you want. So we come up to this idea that new players are great because they haven't opened doors, right? But there's this dichotomy between armchair and the table. So this idea of like rules and the meat and the bones of the game are separate from the experience at the game itself. And there's this weird thing where it's like, okay, we want players that are new and haven't experienced things, but we don't want to tell them which doors to open. We want them to experience the doors that they want to open themselves. Like, so it's like, open some doors, please, but we're not going to tell you which ones. And guess what? Each one of them has a different vibe and a different feel. And guess what? Each one of them have different rules that you're going to forget and that make them unique and different to each other. I think that's really funny. So, Mr. Runehammer, sir, in your professional experience, what do you think is the, not correct, but your subjective opinion, when is the proper time to rotate your game out? Like, when do you need to change the rule set, change the setting, get some different vibes going? And like, do you do that before the vibe dies down? Do you, like, do that before that, like, while everybody's still having fun, are you going to just switch out rules because, oh, it's time to be uncomfortable again because things are too routine?
Well, we The timing is a little bit of a second thing, but the first thing is we do have a term for it, and we call it a season. So, so we do a season, and then we have a group and a season. So this is how I track, like, all my notes. So, you know, like last night was Crown and Skull Season 2, Session 8. And so when we switch a season, we will have either whole cloth, like jump decades in our world, or even switch worlds, switch rules, something. We will do something crazy, and we'll usually talk through it. You know, like, as you mentioned, please open some doors. You know, that talk about, like, a motto for the GM. You know, like, you know, it's like, yeah, there's all this. Down, anybody want some fruit? I've got all this fruit. Like, anybody want some of this? So we will kind of, like, collaboratively move between seasons. So that's the first thing that I would say is we have a word for it. And I think that word is really powerful because, especially since, what, 2017 or something, the idea of seasons has definitely entered our lives because we're like binge TV watchers. So, like, yeah, what used to be a show is now a season. And so, like, if you look at, like, freaking Mando or something, like, compare season one to season three, right? And that's a common thing we talk about nowadays. So I think it's a very strong word to use with players. Like, when you say, you guys, I think let's do another season of the game and kind of let that one stop or let that one be right where it was, I think they quickly resonate with that idea. They know it's going to be similar. Like, Mandalorian season three was a lot like season one, but, you know, it has the same stuff. It's got spaceships. It got Mando. But now, instead of a big ship, he's in a little quick one. And, like, you know, like, so they get it right away, and I think it makes them excited rather than it feeling like some kind of punishment. Right. You know, like that game's over and this game must now begin. So that's part one. And then part two, you greatly show your wisdom, Jake, is that the timing is absolutely critical. And for me, I always, again, following the idea of a season, and hell, let's stick with Mandalorian. Like, I think it was the end of season two of Mandalorian. They had that ridiculous and wonderful scene. Oh, no, it was Boba Fett with, like, it was like the Rancor versus the Speeder versus Stormtroopers versus the Jedis versus the mercenaries. It's like someone, like, dumped their entire bin of Legos out on the floor, and all the Star Wars figures were also in that bin, and it was just lunacy. And that was the last episode. Like, burp, season's over. And that's a lot how we do it. So we will... we'll hit the crescendo of all crescendos and then just stop. And then I will act like I'm all exhausted and, like, pretend to be, like, withering away. Like, oh, I'm too tired from being a game master. Ooh, I need a month off or I'll burn out. You know, and then really all you're doing is waiting for them to get thirsty again. It's a complete trick. It's really mean to do to your friends. But you're doing it. You're depriving them of D&D. And when they get hungry again and you get that first text message that says, you know, guys, hey, man, are you guys still alive? Because I kind of want to play some D&D. Then you know, let's do another season.
Yeah, I love that idea of the seasons. And something you said about this is this game, this session number, this time, you know, of the week, it kind of makes me, my wife is a librarian, so it reminds me of, like, the library. And, like, if you're looking for a specific book, there's a procedure, and you go to this direction and you go down this aisle and it's on this shelf here, and that way the reader knows where to go and what shelves to access the books they want. And that way it's like players and game masters, they know what to expect in that way. So that's awesome.
And I live in a Marvel level multiverse of GMing because of my particular profession. So I live in a freakish prism of interconnected universes and games and one shots and ongoing campaigns. So to me, that's just been pure utilitarian. Like, I, you know, just to keep some modicum of sanity, you know, I've needed session numbers, you know, season numbers, group names, and then usually, like, interconnections or something that I constantly think about. So yeah, that just kind of, librarian is a really, it's very Dewey, the Dewey role-playing system.
Yeah. To keep going down on this librarian theme, I mean, it's no mystery that you're
very talented and skilled in creating these amazing sessions with your friends. But that being said, I find myself, I find it easier to lean on my past experiences and lean into modules that I've ran before rely on this past information to prep game sessions. And sometimes I'm representing entire games, you know, encounters, NPCs, etc. Do you think I'm doing myself a disservice in rewriting past material, whether this is published or homebrewed or elsewise?
Absolutely not. That is not a disservice. I mean, you know, you don't get good at breakdancing by doing a different move every day. You know, you got to do the centipede when you want the crowd to cheer. You know, so if you're good at the centipede, then lay that shit down and blow their minds. You know what I mean? But I think you already, the subtext of your question is that you can feel in yourself that there's more potential and that you lean, like lean was a word I think you used, that like leaning on something you know you're good at. You got to do that sometimes to get a cheer from the crowd. but I think all creative people, whether it be breakdancing or role playing, like, you know, when you're leaning, like leaning isn't really a good word, right? That's a little bit of it. I, you know, as a person who walks around on a freaking prosthetic leg, let me tell you, leaning sucks. That's a little amputee humor there. Anyway, I couldn't pass it up. But yeah, I do think that the greatest spoils go to the bold, right? So, you know, again, back to, you know, what Ross is saying, like, about Traveler. I do think that when you set aside, you know, that kind of classic, like, for me, it would probably be Song of the Fen, which was a module that was in Dragon Magazine, like, number 60 or so. And this is an eternity ago. This is so long ago. But there's, like, a troll in the swamp, and he's singing this, like, sad song. And it probably was inspired by Grendel. And he's kind of like a monster that is troubling the village, but who's also sad. And it's this song out in the swamp. And so a bunch of the villagers are saying, you know, this guy keeps tearing us up and we got to get rid of this guy. But there's a few villagers who are like, you know what? No, it's because we wronged him. And he's sad out there. He's like, he's got a broken heart and stuff. Blah, blah, blah. So fast forward 30 some years. I absolutely still lean on that idea. It's always resonated with me. It still resonates with me, like Grendel resonates with me. But I think to your question, like, should I stop, you know, leaning on, I would say maybe try to not lean on whole modules. You know, like if you're going to a thing and you're only going to see these people once and like that's your only chance, then by all means do the centipede.
Right.
But As far as your creative growth, yeah, you can't be just, you know, running under mountain every month for the rest of time. And, you know, there's somebody I can make fun of real quick. It's Professor Dungeon Master. I'm going to call him out.
I knew you were
going
to say it. Village of Hamlet. I knew you were going to say that.
And I want him, I hope he hears this podcast so I can make fun of him. But so he has this brilliant module that is inspired by Macbeth. And he's an English teacher. And he knows, like, every line of Macbeth by heart, and he does all these hilarious, like, Scottish voices and stuff. But, yo, Dan, you've been running this module, like, 3 times a month for the last 15 years, bro. Like, stretch some new muscles, my man. Okay, I'm done poking at it.
It's so funny. You say the sad troll in the swamp resonates with you. I have found that resonates with me also. Ross can attest to this. I think sad monsters are so compelling, and there's something about that. The big bad guy is just hurt. You know, that to me resonates so deeply. But speaking of monsters, you know, monsters come in all kinds of varieties depending on what your system you're using, what setting you're set in. And I find your ability to take concepts and ideas and twist them, manipulate them into something unique is unrivaled. I've never seen somebody with such a, like an artistic flair to every little monster you bring, specifically like, your toad people, feel so unique, and different. And, Ross can agree that like frog people are like my personal fave. So there's that, but, what is one official, like, officially, I'll put that in like quotations, officially released monster that you refuse to use as is?
Oh, wow. Probably, I guess I would say something like a beholder. I think that there's the plushies and the cartoony treatment of the beholder has reached a point that I would find it very difficult. Or like, you know, he's on the cover looking through the freaking fishbowl, you know, right. And he's like on Xanathar, and he has like all these silly little notes, and like people generally think beholders are like cute little, like it's like Kirby or something. I think it would be very hard for me and my style to bring that. We do have a beholder in one of our worlds called Orgadex, but I don't know if we even really think of it much as a beholder. It's just called this thing called the Watcher. It's more like a big eyeball. It's not really a beholder by brand, but I think that would be, I would avoid that. I would avoid the idea of Xanathar, you know, and like he's floating around in a stone maze enslaving goblins. Like, right. You know, this mega, it's kind of like this mega stereotype, like brain lock. You know, well, if I'm going to have Xanathar floating around in a maze, he's going to have minions. And if he's got minions, they probably set up traps and they probably sleep in hay beds. And like, you start going down this sort of checkbox or so, checklist almost of like what you have to have. So I think I would keep my distance a little bit on a sort of a capital B beholder. You know? And definitely over the years, I've deployed things like beholders, or like a mind flayer would be another one, you know, like a really classic kind of Illithid mastermind, or a Soth type character, or, you know, a lich, you know, whose soul lives in a gem or a ring or something, you know, like some of these like really top of the list kind of guys. I have deployed those in the past, and I gotta say, I did not like them. I would like try to get them killed. You know, I would feel weird. And then the most unexpected supervillains, or even micro-villains. Again, that's that crazy thing about playing with actual people in person, is the things that you think are going to be small wind up being big, and that's the magic.
Yeah, I agree.
And it can be hard to do that with a headliner. You know what I mean? Like, the Beholder is like the Taylor Swift of D&D.
Yeah, I so agree.
So how am I going to mix it up? You know, everybody knows Taylor Swift. Everybody, you know the songs whether you like her or not. You probably know the songs.
Yeah.
So what am I going to, there's no room for me in Taylor Swift concert. Like, I'm just a little dot in the crowd. So I feel that way a little bit with the big top line guys.
Yeah, something that I think is a good metaphor here is, like, I feel like GMing is a lot like doing shadow puppets, and eventually players become familiar with the shadows. Like, oh, I know this silhouette, I know what this is, I know how this acts. And if you're trying to run something like a beholder or like an Illithid, these are supposed to be, like, horrific beings. These are beings beyond understanding and comprehension. They should not be recognizable. They should not be something that is on a plushie on their t-shirt. You know, this is something that they should be uncomfortable about. They should be, you know, the player and the character. You know, this, to me, I think that there should be something uncertain about it and about that. So, like, yeah, I agree that the beholder specifically that speaks out to me is like this thing that does not come across the table the way that it used to. It serves a different purpose now. It serves this, like, it's more like a token now, like, that you put out, and it's up for grabs. This token is up for grabs. Whoever can grab this token wins the game.
I also think it's hard to have a conversation with a beholder.
It's
not believable. You know, it's just so out there. It's just, you know, you're almost better off with, like, a black pudding. The black pudding delivers all the creepy fear of a beholder, but without having to, like, smile at you or some weird shit. You know, like, the best villains to me are always ones that you can have a conversation with. Always. Like, the speaking of the villain is the villainy. You know, their deeds are not impressive. They can massacre whole towns, and it doesn't have a ton of impact. But if you get into a conversation with a villain and they are pissing you off with their smug reasoning and their airtight alibis and how they have you at odds and they have you, like, on lower ground than them and you can't deny it, that will make you hate a villain.
Yeah. I have that problem with NPCs in general. They just, my players just start hating NPCs because of something they said. I was like, whoops.
Enough conversation in your game. It also feels like a wasteland. It feels too empty. So you have to take the chance of conversing with your players as people in the world. And yeah, every once in a while you'll have a guy who's selling mangoes who gets his head cut off.
I only have one more question for you from me, and then we'll hand it back to Ross. But what is a question that we didn't ask you, but you wish that we did ask you?
What, like for my promotional needs?
I mean, it could be for anything. It's just something you wanted to talk about. You didn't get the opportunity to talk about.
Oh, man, I don't know. I don't know, geez.
Like, can I take that and kind of like twist
yeah,
it around?
Jump on yeah, go
jump
for
on it.
It.
Let me think. I like the idea, but like, what is the thing? So I listened to your last podcast, and you were talking about, man, we are doing a lot of talking, a lot of thinking.
Oh yeah.
And it needs to, like, especially like spotlight sharing. Now I got to tell you, that thing. Spotlight sharing is my bane. It's my bane. It's so hard, and it's also fun for me. I have like totally different games. So like in my original D&D type game, we have a hardcore caller, you know, in like book three of original D&D, who's talking? The referee and the caller. And so that's a totally different paradigm. Like, right? That's a whole other way of approaching things.
Yep.
And then we've got like a game that's like more like modern, like a role-playing game, and you really want to keep the energy up, and you want to keep, I either call it moving the spotlight or tossing the ball. Like, all right, come on, let's toss the ball, let's keep it moving.
Yep.
Down the court. And that it seemed like with that idea, like, guys, y'all, we need to actually do this in effect. Like, so what would you say is the thing we ought to be talking about? What is the thing that ought to be, you know, especially in this context of you got a group of people, we're hanging out, we're playing games. And I'm talking about our play club here, you know, and we're playing all these different games. And we're saying we're going to liberate ourselves from the orthodoxy of, like books and voices on the internet, and which is funny because again, voice on the internet.
I'm one
of
those.
Like it's the paradox of the sage, right?
I am the villain.
You point to the moon, and then you look at the finger and not the moon, then you've lost that, right? But anyways, So like, what do you think we ought to be talking about if we're doing the talking? Because that's what we're doing. We're talking.
Yeah, we can't shut up. So yeah.
Yeah,
I think it, that could be a lot of answers on that one. But I think I'd have to give like a timely answer, which is a bit like where I'm at and a little bit the message I feel like bringing in 24. Something I feel maybe is due in culture at large. But I think it's it's sort of a statement about we need to come out of this like digital hibernation that we've been in, and it was put upon us and sold to us as a fun way to like stay in touch with people. That's how it all began. I know a lot of us have completely forgot, but this was like maybe 2007 or so, and MySpace was kind of starting to fade a little bit, and no one really knew why we ever even did MySpace, and it seemed like, wow, it's gonna go away. But then like Facebook hit us, and that grew into what, you know, we're doing like right now. And it was put upon us by masterminds. They very cleverly came up with this stuff. So props to them, good job. But they accidentally like socially engineered a whole like decade, I think. And we not only rely on it now, I think we've gone into a little bit, especially just because of stupid COVID, went into a little bit of a hibernation of being so dang digital. And Lord knows these tools, I use them every stinking day, so I'm not coming at it like, you know, a priest on the mount here. It's quite the opposite. I'm going through the same journey too. And I think the thing to think about as you ask, Ross, would be how do you get people together face to face this year? Like this month, now. Now, I know a lot of people, they right away, the first thing they'll say is like, well, there's nobody in my town, so I got to use Roll20 and all that stuff. And sure, yes, I know that's all real. But I think there's an important call right now that I would want to, that I look forward to putting into the world this year. Of be like, go out there. Go to your homie's house. It's so freaking weird. Like, 10, 15 years ago, it was not weird to go to your homie's house. You just roll in. You're like, give me a beer, dude. You sit on the couch, and you don't even know what the fuck you're doing. You're just over at the homie's house, and you're going to figure something out to do. Can you even imagine? Like, in 2024, that sounds so weird.
Yeah, it sounds really weird because it's like back then I'd be like, oh yeah, we'll go over there, and I didn't have to knock on the door. It was just so different. Now, if I walk up to the door, even if he's not even home, the doorbell is going to send him an email that I'm at his door, and then it's going to be, it's just really awkward because, you know.
Yeah, is going to be up. It's going to make the fake dog bark in the house, and then send messages, there was the phones, and all kinds of stuff.
The reason, part of the reason I say this too, isn't to say like let's change the decade or whatever. It's actually just my personal experience in the last few years, which, as I guess a lot of people who sort of follow me know, like I moved from Washington State, living up by a river in the mountains, to the heart of Philadelphia. Now, why I did this, I don't understand, just because I'm insane. Because I wanted to just check it out. You know, what's the big deal? And Philly, Philly has quite a reputation for being a dense, very open-minded social environment. And I had no idea. I have gotten the hugest education on going to your homie's house with a couple of beers in your backpack and knocking on the door and seeing what the fuck's gonna unfold. This even a little bit goes on beyond D&D, but let's keep it in the role-playing discussion. And I think I want to rally people to overcome some of this hibernation that we've been, I think, almost unwillingly put in by all these tools that we use to stay in touch. Do we use them to stay in touch? Fuck yeah, man. I'm texting my homies and tagging them in pictures and shit like that all the damn time. It's super fun. But I think the essence of what I loved and continue to love about this thing that we do is in that moment of finding people who are oddly enthusiastic about it. And maybe I'm just going to go like for a long walk up in the park. We don't have to like play D&D this afternoon. But it's always cool to like hit knock on a homie's door, be like, bro, I know you're not doing anything. Come on, let's get out here. I'm going to go walk, you know, up the creek trail or whatever. And you wind up just talking about D&D. And like that to me is the thing to talk about and think about. If that serves as an answer, is like this is a good year to wake up from this digital sleep. And like shake a mofo's hand. You know what I mean? Like we got so phobic with all this stuff, and for good reason. I'm not like some kind of weird denier or something. Like that shit was scary, y'all. That was crazy. But it's over pretty much. I know it's like, I know there's details, but we got to like be together in life. You know, we got to have a homie come in and sit down and be like, what's up? Why are you here?
Jake, I'm coming tonight. Get ready.
Oh, yeah, I don't know why I'm here. I don't know why I'm here. I was thinking, hey, what's up? And I got like a free hour. Like, I was just like, what you doing, man? Let's walk your dog or something stupid. But that to me is just the seed of something bigger, which is like play together. I don't know about y'all, but when I was in college and the 5 years after college back in the 90s, we had a cool store in Boulder called White Dwarf. And you could just roll into White Dwarf, and there was like an 8x8 wargaming table there. And wargaming hadn't gotten some, it's somewhat insular nowadays, right? Almost like how Magic got kind of insular. Like, it's very hard to walk in on people playing Magic and just be like, yo, can I get a pickup? You know?
Right.
Hey, I got a red goblin deck, guys. And you'll get laughed out of there, right? But back in these days, you roll in and these guys are like playing some kind of freakish blend of like World War II and Ogre and like Warhammer. Nice. It's like orcs versus Nazis. and with little foam mountains and shit. But that was just kind of what was going on over there. And then kind of over on this other side, there's like a leather couch and there's like a dude reading like second edition. And you're just kind of coming in there and right away it'd be like, hey, what's up? You know, can I help you find something? And it'd be like, I don't really know. You know, I was kind of looking into Ogre or whatever. I was kind of thinking about trying it. And they're like, oh, cool. Well, you know, check it out. And then you're just kind of sitting with the cashier and they'd be like, I don't know. I think Steve Jackson's kind of crazy. I hate GURPS. And I'll be like, oh, I kind of like GURPS. I thought it was kind of cool. I don't feel like a lot of that's happening.
Right.
Like, it's almost like you go into a game store and if you're not like there for a purpose or something, there's like a weird, I don't know. So I want it to come back. That's what I'm saying. I want it to come back. I want to chill with the homies. I want to have secret fist bump handshake things.
Yeah.
After games, you know what I mean? Get a like a 1 hour war game in at like 3 p.m. because fuck, we're badasses. That's
this makes me think, Jake, about your journey, about like the whole one where you started and how you came into tabletop gaming. This is, dude, you know.
Yeah, there's definitely a dichotomy between what used to be a game store and what is a game store now. Like the local stores, I walk in, and if I don't have a product that they, you know, can sell me, then I serve the store no purpose. And to me, that's a very different experience than what it used to be, because it used to be a place to hang out after school.
And that can be your house. You know, we don't necessarily need businesses to do this for us.
That's
that can be,
what
that
I was
could be your
say.
House. Like, hey, you guys, open door policy this week at my crib. You know, like, if you want to come over and argue about your multi-class bullshit, which is I think is dumb and you seem to think is cool, why don't you stop by? We'll have some mac and cheese. You know what I mean? Like bring it all sort of down a notch, so to speak. I think if there's one thing that's on my mind, Ross, like this year, that's probably the biggest thing, is like keep leaning in on face-to-face time with peoples. And, you know, and it, by the way, it's getting easier and easier. Back in the day, somebody just hearing mention of D&D and leaning over to you and saying, oh, yeah, we just started a group, that never fucking happened. That never happened. Nowadays, I can barely get a session in at the gym without somebody being like, hey, aren't you on YouTube? We just started playing D&D, man. Is it cool? And I'll be like, yeah, can I just get these sit-ups done? Because so it's a good time to open up and you know, like meet people. There, it's like spreading like wildfire.
I remember that this is in those days when you could. My wife and I used to say we were traveling D&D salesmen because we would pack up our books and we would go somewhere and put on a game. And we loved level one because I didn't know what the OSR was. So I loved level one and I would do a complete adventure. And I had so much fun doing that. And one of the things I did, so I'm an airline pilot by trade. So I was at O'Hare one day and I was reading Horde of the Dragon Queen, which is, man, that's hard to prep. So I'm here I am trying to read this thing and understand it. And I got the book out and somebody comes up and they're kind of like tentatively like, is that like a comic book? What is that? And I was like, sit down. I'm like in my like airline uniform, you know?
Right.
And he sits down and I put dice on the table and a fifth edition character sheet. I was like, let's do it. I'll show it. And he played his first D&D game there at the airport from the captain of a flight.
Perfect.
A couple of gates down.
So you're already there, man. You're already walking the dusty path of the pilgrim, my friend.
Well, but I don't. You know, that doesn't happen. You know, it hasn't for years. It's true.
Next time you're GMing a game, you just show up in your pilot's outfit. People will be like, what the fuck is this guy doing?
You know, I remember the last time it happened is I tried to, in the neighborhood where I'm at, I was like, all right, I love D&D. 50% of people laughed at me. It's okay, you know. And then the other 50, because I'm in the South and they think that's, you know, effeminate or something.
Uh-huh.
And then the other 50% was like, oh, yeah, I love Pathfinder. you know, and so let's do this. And it was so fractured. And somebody was like, I only, you got to get the Pathfinder books and you got to do that. And I'm like, I don't have Pathfinder, you know, and I'll try to learn, you know. And then somebody else was like, I only want to do cyberpunk. And I was like, okay, well, I'll do cyberpunk. And then another person was like, well, I'm not going to do cyberpunk. And then it all fell apart. And then none of us have gotten it together, you know. And
don't they know that all D&D inevitably leads to cyberpunk?
I would just say, like, we'll take it one step further, and more than a call to meet with your homies, and more than a call to, you know, meet face-to-face, I would say go to your school, go to your church, go to your workplace, if they allow it, go to your bank, you know, hang up flyers. I think, like, advertise your game with your local community and expand your bound of friends. If your friends don't want to play the game that you want to play, I've said this in our podcast before, like, if you don't have a group, build a group. And it's okay if your group is not your friends, and it's okay if you make new friends. You
know, the other one I've been doing is screaming and yelling at cons. So I know that cons are like a staple of like the town meeting, right? And so a lot of people love to play at cons. I freaking hate cons. I'm sorry.
Interesting.
I love everybody. You guys are all really cool. It's not against you. I just don't have fun at cons. I like to shop for some cool shit I've never seen. All right, that's great. But the rest, no. I don't like hotels. I don't like convention centers. So what I've been trying to say, and this would be sort of part of, I guess, my like message that I'm getting fired up about here, is instead of thinking about cons, the word that I've been trying to spread more is the idea of a gathering. And a gathering is one or two or three, maybe, groups. So what's three groups? 12, 15 people. Get together for a weekend. Get your Airbnb, yo. It's easy. Just get together and you can play all weekend. That's it. Go home. Like, it's so simple, and you get like shit tons of mega quality gaming time in. Like the most dedicated, and you can hear the other group like in the other end of the Airbnb, right? And they're going crazy in there. And you're in with your group, and you're going crazy in like the kitchen table. They're in the living room table. You know, and then when you're eating, because you do have to eat at some point, everybody's like commiserating over all their sob stories and their dramatic escapades. And then you go back to the table and you just do that for a weekend. And it's what I think a lot of people dream the con to be. But the con eats so much of your energy with things that aren't playing. Now granted, there is the shop floor. That is untouchable. It's amazing. But The thinking you're gonna like go to a con and get like 15 super quality hours of gameplay, to me, is I know some people do it. I honestly don't know how they do it. I don't know how they can concentrate in the hotel conference room or in the floor where all the people are, or playing with strangers, and then you shuffle that group of strangers into a new group of strangers like an hour later, and like, I can't do it. So maybe I'm just a weakling, but the gathering to me is where I'm going. I've done two so far. I did two in 2023. I did one in the spring and one in the fall. And they were so legendary that like the friendships and the blood oaths that are made after those gatherings are part of what's fueling this kind of fire that you guys are sensing in me right now. Like I am feeling that. And that takes me back to the old days. Like there is no better environment to play D&D than a college dorm. And the reason is you're always in a gathering. There's always 10 to 15 people who are there together, and there's tables, and the sort of the epic blood oath aspect of it, you know, like those bonds that get formed because you're getting in deep. You're like getting to the deep muscle tissue.
Yeah, that's like the intimate fellowship of like summer camp as a kid. You know, I think I have friends at summer camp that I haven't talked to for 20 years, and I still think of them as dear friends because of those memories that we made in those like 3 weeks back in fifth grade or whatever.
Summer camp isn't a store. You know, it isn't
right.
a thing where you're there to buy things. It's there where you are there for the quality time. Like, you're going to canoe together, y'all. Like, this shit's going to be legit. Like, you're going to canoe all damn day. You know, and
I will
think this
is though,
what I want to spread this idea. And it is oddly It is oddly new or unheard of right now. When I talk about gatherings, people are like, huh? You mean like the con? Like going to the con? I'm like, no. No. You know, and it's actually cheaper. People think Airbnbs are expensive and shit. It's cheaper to just get an Airbnb for 10 people and just get in there, make two groups, and play all weekend and order Chinese food. You're done. That's all the logistics you need to figure out. So that's where I'm at. It gets me awfully excited thinking about it. But that is like the what's really fueling me this year is like working toward that.
It's awesome.
All right. Anything else you want to ask, Jay?
No, that's it. I will say, though, that my con experience, at least every time I've gone, it's been more about the food. Like, the food in between the shopping, that's what we go for. Like, we ate so well. Like, especially when we go to Adepticon, go to Schaumburg. There's a lot of good places in Schaumburg, but it's so close to Chicago, and there's so good places in Chicago. Oh, it was so good.
Food con.
All right. Hankern, what... Anything you want to tell people other than get together and play, something coming out, Runehammer, upcoming stuff? I'll put your website in the description.
Cool.
What else should people know about?
Well, I mean, Crown and Skull is, after a journey of 10,000 miles in bare feet, Crown and Skull is finally only about 2 weeks away.
Wow.
And this journey has been so far and so patience testing and such a level up for me too. Like this is basically me and Kane and House DM, who are my two sort of like henchmen. We basically built our own Kickstarter level infrastructure from scratch. So we built a way to do a pre-sale. We got our own logistics, our own warehousing, our own e-commerce, our own like financial back structure, everything. We did the whole thing by hand. Because basically I wanted to outgrow print on demand. Print on demand is freaking awesome. Don't get me wrong. It is beautiful. But I wanted to push like book quality further. And I wanted to push into, like, you know, bigger dimensions of Runehammer, you know? And so we wanted to get into warehousing books, which is a completely different world from doing print-on-demand. And so, like, that's just the sort of the, you know, like the ditch-digging side of Crown and Skull. But Crown and Skull itself, especially now that I'm a zillion sessions into it,
If someone has never played an RPG, what is Crown and Skull?
Crown and Skull is a fantasy RPG that I would say is pressing some frontiers on foundational concepts. So the main concepts that this one is kind of gonna a little bit twist your mind is that in so many RPGs you have hit points and you have stats, and they are not only just in RPGs, they're in video games. They're everywhere. The idea of abstract health and of having stats, and how strong are you, how fast are you, so has become culturally pervasive, not even in games. That is just a universal idea. And those two, especially those two specific ideas, are completely absent from Crown and Skull. There's no hit points and there are no stats. And that is a bit of an elevator kind of gimmick pitch. But I think it gives you a taste for what you're in for with Crown and Skull. And the other thing that is, to me, is a big deal that I'm so excited about and why I wanted to push my book craft to another level is that Crown and Skull is sort of the beginning of my next wave, which is integrating my writing, my fiction writing, into my RPG books in a more seamless way. And this can be overdone, right? You don't want an RPG book with like a 20-page lore dump on you. You know, like, sorry to call you out, Games Workshop, but sometimes you drive me insane with your Warhammer books. So I knew that wasn't quite the best model, but I can't have like no fiction in there either. That's not the best model either. And so how can it be done in a way that works? And I looked to the oldest books that we have, that we know of in our culture, in our civilization, and tried to learn from the original book crafters and how they arranged and constructed books. And Crown and Skull is a call out to that. And people who are sort of a little bit savvy about the history of ancient books, I think will get some extra delight out of Crown and Skull and how it's made and how it's organized in a very, very ancient way. And all those things are really big achievements for me and came at no small effort. Like, really has been a tremendous task to try to capture this feeling. And part of the feeling came from the movie The Ninth Gate, which I guess less people are familiar with than I anticipated, but it's a movie from the 90s
movie. Yeah,
with Johnny Depp. And
looking at old copies of Don Quixote.
Yeah, he's
like
looking at old copies of like satanic books and comparing them. And it's the interesting tactile experience of ancient books. And that movie has inspired me ever since I saw it way back 30 years ago or whatever. It's almost like I see myself in that movie, like my sort of my daily life of searching for books and being fascinated with books. And Crown and Skull is me trying to speak that language and trying to say role-playing books don't have to be colorful 8x10 kid books. You know, and I know that a lot of people like those, and rock on, no shade. But for me, I wanted to dream of a role-playing book that feels like a mature, historic book and isn't fake about it. Is very upfront, and I think the closest analog I could think of would be Burning Wheel. You know, Burning Wheel.
I was wondering if you were going to go with like Wolves of God, where he intentionally, I don't know if you're familiar with that one, Kevin Crawford, because he is a curator of ancient texts,
yeah.
Right? That's his day job, and so he's like, I'm going to make an RPG that's just me making an ancient text written from the point of view of a monk, and then there's a little thing about the actual mechanic, and then I'm going to keep going. And
right.
So, or Burning Wheel too is, yeah, I was wondering which one.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the inspiration for that.
I don't know the Crawford one. I know of it, but I don't have that in my collection. So I don't know that one with the intimacy I'd like to, but knowing Luke personally, Luke Crane, author of Burning Wheel, that book authentically represents him. In a way, he is that person. He is a masterful historian. And the way that he talks, he'll drop like Latin phrases on you thinking they're funny. Like, no, bro. No.
Yeah, no.
So anyways, I just want to if I wanted to plug one thing, it would definitely be Crown and Skull, partially because it's my new coming thing. It's my new big thing that I'm really relying on. But also just, it's really from the heart. This is like a level up for me big time. And I've never made such a long journey from finishing a thing to people getting to really hold it in their hands. I am really impatient as an artist. So like when I get it done, I want it in people's hands like next week. You know, this one has been a journey of almost 6 months just to do all the hard part, the not fun part of book craft, of book creation, and then all the back end with all the business stuff and all that stuff, and trying to mature as a person, you know, and like really deliver a potent release this time. So that's a huge pitch for Crown and Skull. I really look forward to it getting in people's hands.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. So, all right, cool. Well, Hankren, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us.
Yo, yeah, you guys, anytime, man. Thanks for the invite.
Mythic Mountains RPG is a private online play club that focuses on folk RPGs. Folk RPGs are the games that belong to all of us. They're what actually happens at a table between friends. It's their voice that has the authority on what is fun and what works for them. Weekly, we upload our games to allow others to sit in with us. The channel isn't monetized. We don't own the artwork, music, software, or games shown in these actual plays, and you can find links to their authors in the description. Like, subscribe, and share if you wish, or don't. Just like games in person, you're welcome to pull up a chair, sit in, and watch some of our games. No performances, no fancy equipment, just regular people playing folk pencil and paper role-playing games and having a good time. We hope these games will prove a source of enjoyment to anyone just wanting to listen in, anyone looking for examples of how actual groups run and play folk RPGs, and most importantly,
if you haven't found your group yet, you're welcome here at ours. Nope,
yes,
he's working on it.
Do.
Let me turn you up.
I am present also.
Hey, Jake.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Runehammer, sir.
Hello, yeah, I need... How do I turn Noxious Bones up?
Oh, no, am I too quiet?
Oh, here we go. You're yeah, real quiet.
There you go.
I'll just yell into the mic. It should be fine. Turn it down post-recording.
You got to go in until your mustache hits the microphone. That's when you know.
Yeah, if I had a mustache, I can't grow anything. I got like 12 hairs that grow out really long, and I look like a billy goat.
Those are the ones that have to touch the mic.
I got them. We're good.
We're not going to be able to talk about RPG stuff. You already got me cracking up.
Straight to the mustache.
Straight to the mustache.